So again, we're going to have a few people who will be coming in, between now and maybe 5 minutes from now. But we should start. And so this is the part of the course where, I think you will really enjoy people who have done a very significant project with CUDA. Okay? And, with significant performance tuning experience and, a lot of insight into the particular problem area and the insight about how the performance can be best derived with these efforts. So we're going to have John Stone from theoretical computational physics.
Theoretical computational biophysics. Yeah.
Okay. to tell us about the VMD work and in particular the ion placement part of it. And so Tuesday we're going to have Sam Stone who's going to come and talk to us about MRI. In each of these lectures, you will see some fairly deep knowledge, but presented in a presented in a way that people from other disciplines can understand about the problem, right? And then so that you can understand some of the parameters and how that these people deal with the constraints and rules and get around the constraints, and more importantly, how the hardware actually gets utilized in a well-organized way. So I'm not going to take away any more of John's time, and it's also meant to be very interactive. You really benefit more from these kind of lectures by asking questions, okay? And keep in mind, this is going to be a model lecture for you when you give a lecture on your final project. So, think about the kind of things that you would want to do for the particular problem you're going to attack. And the more questions you ask John, the more you're going to be able to formulate your own presentation. Okay, John.
All right, thank you. So my name is John Stone, and as Wenmei said, I'm in the Theoretical and Computational Biophysics group. I actually have a group of my coworkers in the back row there. We had some very good initial successes with CUDA as a result of myself and a few of my colleagues taking Wenmei and David Kirk's class. So today I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the CUDA kernels we've written in my group. And in particular, I'm going to focus on one or two of the simpler ones, which are easy to explain, which don't require a lot of background. I'm going to show you how they're used in an actual scientific application, which in this case is ion placement and time averaged electrostatic potential calculations. I'll talk a little bit about some of the sort of the mental thought processes I go through when I try to come up with a CUDA kernel to accelerate something. And I'll show you one of the applications where we use multiple GPUs in parallel to achieve even larger speedups. So the first application is ion placement. One of the things that you have to do if you're going to do a simulation of a biological molecule is you have to reproduce the real life conditions that molecule exists in a biological system. And so in this case, that means we're going to take a molecular structure that's initially constructed in vacuum, and we're going to add water and ions. All these little red and green atoms here are actually ions that have been placed near this molecule. And those are important for the correct function of these molecules. My colleagues in the back row can actually answer any questions you have about that. But a key point here is that the computational complexity of this work goes up tremendously as the size of the molecule gets larger. So while we could do this using one of 15 different methods on a CPU for a very small molecule, when you get into the realm of a multi-million atom structure, such as one of these ribosome molecules or one of the virus structures that you'll see later, the computational complexity balloons to the point that it becomes problematic. So while in a normal, everyday scientific process, and let's say what's called a workflow, this would be just one little tiny preparation step needed before somebody can begin a simulation that might run for months on a supercomputer. Once they get to this size, it is now a brick wall, and it's a problem. And we can't use the algorithms and techniques that we would normally use for something this large. So our group had to basically develop our own tools to do this ion placement process for structures of this size, and in particular for nucleic acid structures, which have a very different behavior that the normal methods don't really solve for us.
So John, Dave Kirk and Dan Vivoli have been talking about this the third branch of science, computational experiments. And I think that slide was a really good slide that shows how the tire really hits the road. Mm-hmm. Where some of these real challenges in computational experiment really come about. Right.
Yes.
All these, what you're saying is there are so many steps in these experiments, and each of these steps can be prohibitive.
Yes.
Right.
I mean, in fact, the very individual responsible for this work at the very beginning is sitting in the back row there. Peter, raise your hand, Peter. Peter came to my office one day and said, John, you've got to help me. I need to place ions on this huge structure. His was actually a virus structure, which you'll see later. He said, I did a back-of-the-envelope calculation, and it might take a month to do this.
It was 42 days.
Yeah, so like 42 days. And I said, 42 days? I said, what are you doing? And so we went and we worked on this code on the CPU, and we made it faster, and then we ran it in parallel, and we did various things to speed it up. And ultimately, we got it down to a couple of days, and we were using hundreds of CPUs to run this stuff. This was, but this was unheard of. We'd never needed to do this before, so we'd never encountered this kind of problem. Well, that got worse as we started doing more of these simulations, and we wanted to do other things besides ion placement. So the point of ion placement is basically to place these little ions and balance out the electrostatic field of the structure so that it actually works like it does in the real biological environment. The way this process works is we calculate the electrostatic field for the entire structure with all of the atoms. So that's the first step. So that's basically before we do anything, we first calculate an electrostatic field around that whole molecule. Once we've done that, we then find, in an iterative process, we find the position in space, the lattice point, or the voxel that has the minimum potential value. Once we find that location, then we add a new ion at that location. We repeat this part of the process over and over and over until we've added as many ions as are needed. So oftentimes, we might begin with this first step. We might have a million atoms. So you can see there's a huge amount of work here. We might be adding 1,000 more ions as the last part. So clearly the bulk of the work here is this initial calculation. We could in fact ignore this part entirely if we wanted to and just focus on making this part faster. So there are actually a number of different ways for calculating these electrostatic potential maps. But this method, which we'll call direct Coulomb summation, is a very straightforward method. It has a lot of parallelism, and it's well suited to the GPU. And for today's purposes, I'm only going to talk about this algorithm because the others are way more complex, and you start to get into trade-offs in the science, whether or not you can use different algorithms, and where they're appropriate depends on the size of the system you're simulating, and how accurate the placement has to be, and various other factors, which we won't get into today. So, but the basic algorithm is very simple. For each grid point in space, we're basically going to sum the contribution over all atoms, where the contribution is determined by the charge divided by the distance to that atom from that grid point. So you can see that's a trivial, theoretically, it's a trivial calculation. We're just doing some distance calculations from the lattice point we're considering. We need to look up the charge for each atom, and then we're calculating that square root of the distance squared, and we're all set. So here's a graphical representation of what we're actually calculating. So if we're considering one lattice point, in order to calculate the electrostatic potential at that point, we're going to go over all the atoms that are out there. In this case, I've just got a picture that shows two, but we calculate the distance from the center of that atom to the grid point being considered. We basically divide that partial charge for that atom by the distance, and we sum that to that point, and we repeat it for all the atoms that are out there. Any questions so far?
So you're calculating the potential for every.
And one thing that's kind of nice about this algorithm is this spacing can be arbitrary. It can be as high or as low resolution as you care to calculate, because there aren't any complex data structures that have to be maintained. And some of the more complex, higher performance approximation based methods like multi-level summation or some of the other methods that are out there, you have much more complex data structures that have to be built and maintained, and they scale with the size or the resolution of the grid, and there are numerical methods that work at some resolutions and not others. So the nice thing about this algorithm is it's very simple, as you can see.
So this is what I mean by first or second cousin of graphics application.
Yes.
Because every grid point, in my mind, is similar to a pixel.
Yeah.
And, you know, every of these atoms are triangles that contribute or not contribute to the pixels.
That's right. Yeah.
So that's why I think, you know, MRI, when you guys look at the MRI application, there's also a fairly strong, you know, correspondence there. So these are the applications that tend to give you very, very high, you know, speed up on this kind of hardware, because simply because they're close cousins.
And right. And they have a tremendous amount of inherent parallelism.
Yeah.
That may be the thing that the first cousin applications really have more than almost anything else, is that they have a tremendous number of independent parallel calculations, or it's easy to extract that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and so that's the first point here, is basically what makes this interesting is the direct Coulomb summation is highly data parallel. As you can see, we have, let's say, n grid points, m atoms. We have a huge amount of parallelism. If we had an even bigger GPU with thousands of units, we could parallelize it in actually more dimensions than we're doing now. So right now we're going to take a particular decomposition that's well suited to these GPUs, but we could actually unroll it even further to extract more parallelism at once than we do presently. So another key point is, for our application, since we're just looking for minima, a single precision floating point is more than adequate for this particular purpose at the present of the sort of the lost bits, as you have unaligned exponents and multiple floating point words. You can basically keep track of the bits that are being lost during summation in another separate accumulator, and then you can add that accumulator back in at the end of the summation to get a more accurate result than you would get doing just straight single precision arithmetic. Another way to do this is there are methods that basically extend the floating point precision by using multiple floating point words, aligning all their exponents together, and you can sum into multiple floating point registers, and it can get actually, I think, up in the range of 50.
If David ship us a bunch of double precision capable cards,
mm-hmm.
but the double precision is slower,
mm-hmm.
much, much smaller,
right.
Slower. Would you rather use the double precision straight, but in a slower mode, or would you rather use the single precision and, you know, pay for those tracking of the extra, the lost bits and so on?
Well, it really depends a lot on the algorithm. I think that for some algorithms, when you really don't know whether you're going to run into ill-conditioned data that might stress the approximate extended precision tricks,
yeah.
A lot of those work by locking the exponents of multiple floating point words so that the words line up and all the mantissas line up. One of the things that you lose as a result of that is you can't have wildly varying exponents. Rather, with the normal double precision floating point number, you can have any exponent mantissa you want, and it you don't have to worry about those.
So how about for this one?
For this one, I could do either. I don't actually. It would depend a great deal on what the relative speed of double precision is. For this one, for example, I haven't done it with the latest version of the code, but one of the early versions of the code, I compared the performance of doing compensated summation versus just doing straight single precision arithmetic, and the difference in speed was relatively minor.
And the quality of result is still good.
Yeah, and the quality of the result was still good. And it's funny because in some cases, this is not necessarily one of them, but for the people that do wave simulations and things like that, even with double precision, they have to use compensated summation, or they have to use multiple double precision words so that they don't get floating point cancellation when they sum millions and millions and millions of elements. And so it can throw off their results by multiple percent. I mean, you can actually do this test for yourself. A simple example, this came up in one of our real codes. We had a code that was calculating the mean atom position over time for a trajectory. And when you sum millions of atoms over thousands of time steps, we were getting errors in the 1 to 2% range because of destructive cancellation. And that was just using single precision arithmetic. Well, we had thought that this would have been good enough, but in fact it wasn't. So that code had to be rewritten with more precision to get a better result. Exactly. And especially, you can have a wide range, you know, depending on what it is that you're summing. Yeah. Okay. So another way you can solve that is to order your summation into groupings of like values. So if you add large numbers to large numbers and small numbers to small numbers, if there's a way for you to do that for free in your algorithm, either by processing things in a certain order or by keeping track of the size of the quantities that you're working with, you can do things in these summation groupings, and if you keep the like with like, then you won't have this destructive cancellation, and you can end up adding them up at the end, the separate accumulators, and get the same quality results. So that's another trick. Some other algorithms use that spatial summation, sort of like octrees, and so if you divide space into halves and you process different halves first, or and you subdivide, there are other ways of doing these summations to avoid those problems. But of course, in those cases, you have bookkeeping to keep track of, well, which one do I add next? So, but this is something to keep in mind, because you might find that you have an algorithm that lends itself to doing this either at low cost or maybe even for free. And if you can do it for free, then you can often get away with using single precision arithmetic just by doing things in the intelligent way. So, or you can even make a trade-off. You can say, if I burn a few more arithmetic or operations in some part of my GPU kernel, I will have the free time to do the math, to order to sum things in a particular order, and if I do that, then I get better accuracy. And if you do it right, you can actually get as good or better accuracy than you would get on the CPU.
So the speed ratio is going to be close to 1 to 10. So
yeah.
I think these kind of things will remain important for a while.
Yes, well, and that's my feeling too. These should be kept in mind. A lot of these tricks are coming back. People used to do these things all the time before double precision arithmetic was free, as it were, on a CPU. But now that we have a number of platforms out there, GPUs, Cell, and others, where the hardware differences in the cost of the single precision versus the double precision are now showing up again in the real world performance, all these. I mentioned this before, in the particular application we're talking about today, about 99% of the runtime is consumed in the initial potential math calculation rather than updating it after we add ions. And one reason why this is interesting, it's useful both for structure building and also for visualization. And this particular algorithm is a good template for a number of very similar calculations. So another example would be calculating a synthetic density map from a molecular structure. So you have all your atom positions, and you want to synthesize what's called a density map to emulate the sort of data that an cryo-electron microscope gets. So you can compare your 3D molecular structure that you've gotten from your computation, actual cryo-electron microscopist has determined experimentally. That's a nice way to do that. Another reason to do that sort of calculation is to build. And another one, a gentleman from Wisconsin contacted me, and they're using a variation of this to accelerate a molecular docking application that they're working on. So there are various. So here is the actual CPU C code to do this calculation. This is the simplest form of the code. There's no optimization here at all. So what you can see is there's basically an array of atoms And these atoms are, this array contains the x, y, z coordinates, Cartesian coordinates of the atoms. Their corresponding partial charges, that's in the fourth position in the array. And then we have a loop that just basically processes all of the grid points in the potential lattice. And for each grid point, it loops over all the atoms in the array, calculates the distance from the current grid point to the position of the atom. So you can see that right here, very simple. Divides the partial charge of that atom by the distance and sums it to the energy accumulator. And we basically keep doing that in this loop. And when we've completed that loop, that energy is assigned to the final grid point, that potential map lattice point.
So essentially, this is like a struct of array of little group in the array is the XYZ
Q, yeah, XYZ Q being charged, yeah, that's right.
So what's the decision about, what leads to the decision of this layout? Is it, are these four always accessed at the same time, so it's
yes.
worthwhile to group them together? In
that's
some cases,
correct.
You want to separate them, right?
In this particular case, there were actually two reasons, some of which you wouldn't notice by looking at this particular code. So one is XYZ are, of course, accessed together in this implementation. So you can see, and then there the results of the computation for dx, dy, dz are immediately used right after those accesses. And then the charge is used once you have the distance. So in this particular case, the kernel is so simple, we're going to access all four of those elements basically concurrently. You could think of them as being, we could put these calculations in any order there, but they're all within a few instructions of each other. Another reason to put them in a single array as opposed to two separate arrays or more turns out to be that when you want to implement this with SSE on a CPU, there are various rules that govern the stride and access patterns that the SIMD units on the CPU is allowed to take. By putting the charge in the same array, this ends up giving us a nice grouping of four elements instead of three. And that happens to allow us to use the four-element stride, which is one of the ones that SSE likes. And so we can basically, just with that little, this is one of those little things, if you were to try to make this code fast and you weren't aware of that, you'd hit a brick wall until you realized a little bit of twiddling around in the way that you store the data will allow the compiler to automatically do this for you. So this is another one of those things. When you're writing the code for a CPU with SSE, unlike CUDA, where you have explicit control over exactly what's going on with the CPU and the traditional compilers, you end up enabling all the optimization flags, and then you have to arrange things to allow the compiler to do its work. Because you don't really have a nice way to force it to do it, you have to coax it into doing what you want. And so you end up writing this a few times and seeing what the machine instructions or assembly language that the compiler generates are, and then you go back and you say, aha, the compiler gets it now, thank you. Well, these are calculating one plane. You're exactly right. So I've simplified this a little bit because you're just looking at the innermost loop and this is only doing one slice. So if you think of like a Rubik's Cube or a 3D grid, we're doing one 2D plane at a time. And I'll show you the reason for this later. One reason for doing it is that if we do a plane at a time, we can run multiple planes concurrently on different GPUs.
Do the planes have some kind of correlation? Do you have to consider them together?
No. In fact, that's one of the cool things about this algorithm is every single grid point can be computed completely independently. Now, if you want to reduce your floating point arithmetic, you can calculate certain components of this distance vector ahead of time for an entire plane or entire row or entire column of this grid and reuse it repeatedly. So in fact, as we go to the next versions of the code, I'll show you four versions of this code, we use some of these optimizations. In the CPU, you can do every single one of them because you don't need the parallelism. There's a trade-off, though, as you start to pre-calculate things, you're sacrificing some of your available parallelism. So there's a little give and take in terms of how much do I pre-calculate and is it better to pre-calculate more, lowering my arithmetic per atom evaluation, or is it better for me to do some redundant arithmetic and blast it out on a large number of floating point units on the GPU. And in this case, for the CPU, it's always better to pre-calculate as much as is humanly possible. So that's why I say this is a very low performance version, because it doesn't pre-calculate any of the distance components, it doesn't reuse any of that information. But in real life, the highly optimized CPU version is about, I would say it's 10 times longer than this code here. And so I can't even show it. I can't even show you one piece of it, of the highly optimized SSE version, but that's essentially what it does. It pre-calculates a whole bunch of things and reuses them repeatedly to get higher performance.
But when you move to multi-core, the code will begin to look more and more like this.
That's true, yeah. Yes. Yep, and actually the SSE version, because we only, at the present time, we only have, say, up to, we'll call it 8 or 16 cores is the largest that's really common. There's still, because we have the parallelism in the Z dimension, that's more than adequate to keep any normal shared memory machine busy at the present moment because of the average size of the problem that people want to compute. So, to give you an example of how this is typically used, the density of atoms in space in a biological system is a tenth of an atom per cubic angstrom. So that means we, and because we want to calculate this grid at a particular resolution, we end up with about 20 to 40 lattice points per atom for a typical biological structure. So that gives you some sort of a correlation, you know, that, so if you have a million atom system, you're going to have at least 20 million grid points, maybe more. So that gives you an idea how the problem scales. So as we increase the size of the structure, we're guaranteed to have a much larger grid that we have to compute. So that tells you what the computational complexity is going to be. So it basically ends up being, if n is your number of atoms, you're basically looking at n to the fourth power divided by a large constant because of this scaling factor. But it's very costly. So that's why we have other. So the of these things, because we know this ratio here, we know that the atom list is going to be smaller than the lattice points, the list of lattice points or scalar potential values. So what that tells us for a CPU, that's the best choice for the innermost loop. And as it turns out, because we have small, fast memory areas on the GPU, it is also a good choice for the GPU. We can calculate the lattice point coordinates on the fly, so we don't actually have to store those. That's one thing we can eliminate right off the bat, so we don't have to store those at all. They are relative to the origin of the potential map, and so that eliminates the need to do offset calculations for the position of the atom, the origin of the map, and the voxel address, or the lattice point address within the map. We can also, as I said before, we can pre-calculate some of the distance components, such as the dy squared, dz squared, and update them on the fly for each row for the CPU version. And the CPU version benefits tremendously from SSE. Just to give you an example, and in fact, this is a case where this code, the inner loop is so compact, it's so simple, there is a huge difference between the performance achieved by GCC, for example, and the Intel C compiler. The Intel C compiler, typically on this code, outperforms GCC by a factor of 20. That's a big performance factor, considering that they both target the same type of CPU, and they, in theory at least, have the same knowledge of the hardware and are both supposed to be able to use SSE. But the difference in this case is the Intel compiler does a much better job of expressing that innermost loop efficiently. And that makes a huge.
Quickly break down the 20. You know, what are the factors in those 20? In the 20?
There are a number of factors. So GCC, for some reason, fails to fully utilize the SSE hardware on the CPU. I'm not sure why, but
memory disambiguation.
Yeah, it could be. I've tried writing the code several different ways to, once again, as I described, coax GCC into doing the right thing, but it doesn't seem to pick up on that, and it doesn't utilize the hardware to its full potential. Another case there is that the Intel compiler generates much less, cruft or unnecessary instructions within that innermost loop. It doesn't do various type conversions and things like this. You have to do a lot of things just to get it to do its job efficiently, like prevent it from converting from single precision to double precision and back again, or some of those kinds of problems that you can have with different compilers. Those would be, I mean, basically if you multiply all those factors together, you end up getting that factor of 20. But I think the largest single detrimental factor for GCC was that it is not taking advantage of the SSE vectorization in the same way that the Intel compiler is. It also, I think, is that the instruction timing or the particular optimization, I think GCC and the Intel compiler, you know, if you run them on an Opteron, the performance is much closer. If you run it on the Intel CPU, though, the instruction scheduling done by ICC is vastly better.
But that's the reason why I asked that question is, you know, they're going to have to compare the CPU and GPU computation, you know, against the CPU only computation.
Yes.
So, you know, this is one thing that, you know, we always run into, and you know, I want to make sure that the class has better.
That's actually
insight.
A good point, because when we first did this GPU version, we at that time had not fully, I was still working on the SSE version on the CPU to get it to peak performance. And I got it to go another factor of 4 faster from the early stage to, you know, later on when it was a little more mature by tweaking little things in the code and allowing it to pull some of the loops. I mean, I got a factor of 2 late in the game, actually. I was surprised because I made a small change to the CPU kernel that I had an idea as by guaranteeably unrolling a loop by 8. And then fixing up any damage that caused at the end. So I had to add special code so that I could tell the CPU compiler, go ahead and do 8 at a time no matter what. I don't care what the size of the grid is, do 8, period. And then I had to go handle the case where it went too far. I'd have to undo what it did as a cleanup step at the end of the loop, which was very ugly and adds another half a page of code. But it ends up running twice as fast, so it's worth doing.
And this is, in general, a very important insight that many people in the field don't have. You know, a lot of people listen to my GPU performance presentations and will say, oh, this thing is ugly. You know, you guys had to spend so much effort to get the performance. And I said, you know, I don't think you actually have experience getting high-performance CPU code.
That's absolutely correct. I think the average, when I see people say things that are very critical about CUDA or GPUs or things like this, I honestly think they haven't spent enough hours
on this
trying to extract peak performance out of the CPU. It's not easy in either case. And the truth is, if you haven't done the work, you won't get the performance in either case. In order, you know, it's almost a necessary precondition before you even work on the GPU. You should really understand the algorithm. Because your reference CPU code won't be fast either if you don't have those things. And, you know, like I said, I went back to the CPU version and made another factor of 2 difference after having written the first few GPU kernels because I had another idea.
Okay, good.
Yeah. So some of the sort of my approach, how I go about writing these CUDA kernels in the first place, is I first, you know, for whatever problem I'm trying to solve, I try to find an algorithm that will give me a large amount of parallelism. That is a key point for CUDA, because we have thousands of floating point operations we want to throw on this big grid of streaming processors. And we want to have enough of them independently calculated that we can basically overlap the global memory accesses and things like that and keep all that hardware busy. So that's a key point. We might have several choices available, but you have to keep an open mind to choose the one that has more parallelism, even if it isn't necessarily the most efficient. So another key thing that you do early on is identify the best GPU memory subsystem to store the different data that you're going to be working on it. So the choice of whether to put something into constant memory, shared memory, texture memory, or global memory is critical. Those are some of the first things I play with when I write a new kernel. In the case of this kernel that I'll talk about, I went through several different versions where the arithmetic part of the code was exactly the same, and the only thing I was evaluating is, do I get better speed when it's fed from texture memory, from constant memory, or if I choose this right, many of the things that you do later won't be effective. So getting that selection right is very important. So then, like I said at the beginning, are there things that I can do? Can I make trade-offs that exchange some arithmetic intensity for more parallelism? If I can, for example, add a few floating point operations to an inner loop, but it gives me 10,000 threads instead of 100, that's worth doing. If I can maybe add a couple of extra floating point operations here or there, and it makes something independently calculatable instead of having a dependency, that's worth doing too. So those are counterintuitive. In fact, this is the hardest. I think people are so trained to program for CPUs because Jim and I beat our heads against the wall a couple of times because you are just, it's inherent, you know, you're, all of your experience tells you I should do this to get it to be fast, but that isn't necessarily the way it is. Sometimes you want to do the opposite of what you would do on a CPU because you have to remember there are thousands of floating point units on that GPU and they're just dying for you to give them something to do. And so that's very important. So from my point of view, what that means is occasionally the quote brute force method is the good method, or it's the best suited method. We, you know, oftentimes you'll try various smart optimizations that will reduce the amount of floating point work that you're going to do, but they end up running slower because they have they add dependencies or they take away from the amount of parallelism that you have. So sometimes it's better to go with the, you know, the easy algorithm. It's funny, it's counterintuitive. You just have to keep an open mind to that. I would say keeping an open mind is maybe the big thing to take away from this is if you go into writing your code with a preconceived idea of what is going to give you the best performance, sometimes you'll walk away very surprised. So, and anyway, that's the thing. And the last is you might end up writing several different kernels. Of the kernels that I'll show you shortly, some of them perform, they have a much higher peak performance than the others, but only for large size grids. And for smaller grids, one of the lower performance kernels actually wins. And so this is something you have to keep in mind. When you find these different solutions, you'll have a different portion of the scaling curve where one of the kernels will do better and the other will lose, and vice versa. Any questions about any of those things? Because they're important. Back to the direct Coulomb summation algorithm. The first thing to note is that basically you saw the original code. There is a low ratio of floating point arithmetic compared to the number of memory transactions, at least in the context of a GPU. You saw basically we're calculating a few distances, and we're calculating a square root and a divide, and we're adding a number. And there's basically there are a few flops there, but we're doing as many memory references as we are flops almost. It's all, you know, it's maybe 2-to-1 arithmetic to memory references. And we are going to be zipping through that innermost loop, adding those potential values for each atom very, very fast. So this is actually going to be a bottleneck because the GPU will starve for data unless we make changes to the kernel to reduce the amount of memory references that are needed to keep it busy. So since the atoms are read-only, they're not changing, we can either put them in texture memory or constant memory. Now, in my testing, early on, one of the first things I actually tried texture memory first. But I quickly discovered that despite the fact that texture memory is cached and has locality patterns and all these other beneficial properties, it has a lot of overhead because it's a complex machine and it can do a lot of things beyond just fetching values from memory. And so that extra capability has some overhead, and it turns out that for our purposes, since every thread is going to sum the same atoms, but to different grid points, we can use the constant memory very efficiently because it turns out in their inner loop. And so those constant values will be broadcast to everybody, and that results in, as it turns out, an optimal performance for the constant memory, which is the case that the same value is being broadcast to all the threads. And that gives us a speed that's almost the same as reading from a register. So that's as fast as we're going to get as far as a memory system is concerned. The difficulty with constant memory is it is not infinite sized. It's very small. So we can only hold about 4,000 atoms in there at a time. And so that means we'll have to do the calculation in multiple passes by grouping, doing a summation for 4,000 atoms, completing, doing another 4,000 atoms completing, and so on.
So essentially, you tile the break them into blocks.
Yes.
Make them into tiles, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Is that three-dimensional or two-dimensional tile?
In this case, it's two-dimensional. And in one of the other algorithms, multi-level summation, we use three-dimensional tiles because of the nature of the algorithm.
So let's just kind of add to this a little bit. Texture memory gives you some very nice linear accumulation capability. So if you need to interpolate some values linearly with multiple points, neighboring points, texture memory can actually be very nice.
Yeah, you can get that for free. And
exactly. But your computation here does not have that heavy-duty interpolation activity. And from our experience, unless you have that kind of activity, it almost never pays off.
That's right.
Okay.
And that's actually exactly what I found very early on. And I was initially surprised, but when it was explained to me, well, the texture unit does a lot of heavy lifting. If you're not making use of all the capabilities it has, then it's not going to be a performance one.
Because
it's just getting
it
started, Yeah, exactly. So for the GPU, basically we want to access constant memory efficiently. In versions that use shared memory, we have to avoid bank conflicts. For global memory, we have to attempt to get memory coalescing, and we also want to try to overlap arithmetic with global memory latency by having enough flops running to keep the GPU busy. And another key point here is that we will, in order to simplify the logic inside the kernel, we will write the kernel so that it always does the work no matter what. If we do a map that is smaller than the dimensions of the tiled grid or the CUDA grid of blocks, we will do the math even off the edge of the map. So we will actually pad the map out with extra elements, and we'll do the math on them anyway, even though they're wasted, because it's faster to waste the arithmetic. This is one of these, faster to waste the math than it is to worry about specially handling those edges or not doing things off the edge. So the way this works then is we allocate and initialize the potential map grid memory on the host CPU. We allocate a buffer on the GPU, which will hold one slice at a time. So that's one of these 2D slices. We will then pre-process the atom coordinates and charges. Basically what that means is we will pre-calculate the dz squared component of the distance vector. Since we're doing one slice, we already know what that dz value will be for every atom that we're considering. So we build an array of atoms that already has x, y, dz squared, and q, the charge, and we will get that ready. And then for each slice, we will copy the slice from the host to the GPU, loop over the atoms, or groups of atoms. If we have more than will fit in constant memory, we have to do this multiple times. So if we have, say, 1 million atoms, we're going to be doing this iteratively, maybe hundreds of times until we get all of them done. So for each iteration, we copy the atom data to the GPU. We run the CUDA kernel on the atoms and the slice that's on the GPU. And when that's complete, running all those iterations, we will copy that slice back to the host, and then we free the resources and we're done. Any questions on how that works? It's pretty straightforward.
So what did you have to pick any particular ordering for what atoms you copied at a given time, or is
no.
just like pick a?
It doesn't matter, but if you're smart, you would, since we're already having to do, this is going back to that earlier slide, since we can only do 4,000 at a time, why not pick 4,000 that are closely nestled in space? Mm-hmm. Excuse me. So for example, let's say they're in one of these corners up in this area right here. We will have much less floating point precision error by summing potentials for atoms that are in the same small region in space than we would if we sum them from all over the grid.
Right.
So one thing we can do is if we spatially order those atoms and do them 4,000 at a time in a predetermined order, we'll have a more precise result than we would if we just process them.
That has to be divided by the distance.
That's right.
So,
mm-hmm.
so that's why you have the order of magnitude.
That's exactly right. So for example, when we're considering this grid point here and we have a block of atoms here, their distances are almost the same. They're very slightly different, and it's a large value, and so they'll practically be the same number. In fact, this is the very property that approximate methods take advantage of, is for very distant contributions, you can actually get away with simplifying this math significantly and approximating a contribution as a sort of a blob instead of a bunch of individual atoms. But in the same way, that also helps if we have locality when they're very close. If we're calculating the potential for this corner and we're looking at a group of atoms here, these are very much larger values. And the fact that they're close together, though, when we sum them, it won't be as destructive as if we summed an atom from here for the huge contribution and an atom from here with a very small one where the contribution. So with the simple versions of the code without any unrolling, each thread will just compute one potential. It will not process more than one grid point. And so I'll show you how that's done. So we start with 16 by 16 CUDA thread blocks, and they're a good starting size because that gives us 256 threads. That's enough to hide a little bit of latency. That's enough to keep the GPU relatively busy before it has to start running off. And the blocks are small enough that the, the blocks are small enough that this waste at the edges tends to be smaller. So if we have a 16 by 16 block, the worst case scenario is we have only one, let's say a worst case scenario would be we do one element out of 256. So that in that particular one, and we'd have the waste on the edges. The bigger these tiles are, these thread blocks, the larger the potential waste can be at the edge due to the pattern.
So John, mention the slide number once in a while, just to keep the...
So that was on slide number 14.
Yes.
So now we're going to look at the first version of this kernel, and we're doing pretty well on time, I guess. So the direct Coulomb summation version 1 is basically we use constant memory. We're going to pre-calculate the dz component of the distance vector for all the atoms ahead of time. And this algorithm actually, this is one of the first ones I wrote, and it performs very well. I think maybe in a few hours of work I already have this level of performance. So that's 187 gigaflops, about 18 billion atom evaluations per second. That's actually very good. That, as I recall, that is already 10 times faster than the fastest CPU kernel I was ever able to write. So that was, and this is in maybe my first or second version. This was the first one that used they do. So in fact, the only thing that matters, this is just to give you an idea of your rate of execution of flops for the hardware. So we know that the hardware can do 340 if you're not using the texture unit. So this tells me I'm a little over 50% of the hardware's capability, right? But for an application, the only thing that matters, period, is the rate of work being done. And in this case, that's the 18.6 billion atom evaluations per second. So this is the only thing we can compare between different implementations. The gigaflops rate is interesting, but it's only representative of anything or meaningful in so much as you're doing exactly the same calculation. And you're absolutely correct. As we go through different versions, we will do various things that will reduce the amount of arithmetic, some things that will increase the amount of arithmetic. And so the gigaflop rate is just interesting in terms of, well, we have the ability to hit 340 in a perfect world. We're about half perfect right now. So this tells me that 50% of my time is not being done, or floating point operations are not being done, so we're doing something else. So what is that something else? So the good parts about this algorithm are we're zipping over the read-only atoms, and the constant memory is performing very well. As I mentioned before, because all the threads are reading from the same element at the same time, the speed is approximately the same as reading from a register. The bad part about this algorithm is, so this is a limitation, I guess, not necessarily bad. The constant memory only holds 4,000 atoms, so we have to do this in multiple kernel invocations. And we have to shuffle this data in and out of the CPU for each pass.
So did you do this in a way that if future constant memory increases, you can quickly take
I can. It's just a size parameter, that's all. In fact, I guess I should update the code constant memory, of course, is the way you define those things right now is a compile time. So I suppose I would have to recompile.
Yeah.
But if it wasn't that way, if I could dynamically allocate constant memory, I could just tie it to a parameter, and it'd be easy. And I actually did have to change this because when you build in 64-bit mode, the CUDA compiler consumes a few of these elements for itself.
Yeah.
And so I used to use about 4,090, and I had to drop it down by because the first time I ran the kernel on 64-bit mode, it terminated, and I thought, well, that's odd. And so then I
that's a little rude.
I compiled it with the CU bin option, and I looked, and it said the constant memory was basically too large, and I thought, oh, well, there's the problem. So, but it was easy to fix. So this is actually what the kernel looks like. So you can see we're basically calculating the grid, the potential map lattice point there. We initially zero out the energy for the potential. And then for each atom, we're basically zipping through, calculating those dx, dy. The dz was already calculated and stored in this array, so we don't have to calculate that. That saves us one flop. But the rest is more or less similar to what you saw on the CPU.
It didn't show is atom info array is declared in the constant memory.
That's right, yes. The atom info array is in constant memory. And this is slide 16. For all of these, I'm perfectly happy to provide you with the source code to the whole program so you can see for yourselves exactly how this is done.
Question.
Yes.
What's with the 1.0 over square root?
This is what I submitted as a feature request / bug report. We had to do this because, and I don't know if it's still happening with CUDA 1.0, but with the earlier versions of the CUDA compiler, if I didn't express this as 1.0f divided by square root f, it would actually calculate the normal square root instead of the reciprocal square root in the hardware, leading to a 25% performance drop, approximately. But by writing it this way, for some reason the compiler understood what we wanted and implemented it appropriately. But if I just wrote atom info, atom ID, w, divided by square root f, it would not do that. And so I submitted a bug report immediately. I'm not sure what the state of that is, but okay. You know, this still works, so I've left the code here.
Right.
So at least it doesn't do any harm. It does look very odd. In the source code, I have comments stating exactly what that is and why.
So John is referring to the fact that in the hardware, there's really an inverse square root.
Yes.
You know, a hardware implementation, there's no square root implementation. So what he really wanted to accomplish is to calculate the inverse square root and just multiply that to the first term, right?
That's right, yeah. So
this is how he forced it.
Yeah, we don't actually want to do a divide. A divide would be a terrible thing, but it turns out that the compiler doesn't, it does what we want, but only if we write it in this strange way.
So it doesn't do the I square root or something.
R square root is, yeah. It will if we write it this way. It will actually emit. This is why I don't have the slide in here this time, but I had a slide in the last version of this talk called Never Trust the Compiler. And in that slide, I basically advocate read the PTX code that the compiler emits so that you can verify that it's doing more or less, at least, what you're aiming for. The PTX isn't a guarantee because there's still a back-end compiler and they can be transformed again from what you see in the PTX code. But by writing it in this way, for example, I could see that the PTX that was being emitted had a reciprocal square root, which is what I wanted. So
it's just a little surprising that there's no a reverse square root intrinsic function call.
Yes. Well, there might, you know, I haven't gone back to look to see if they've added one yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if they had one.
They would have avoided all this trouble if they just did that.
Yes. But this was also, you know, another thing, though. When you're writing your code for the GPU, a lot of people just take their CPU code and they cut and paste it in there. That being the case, and in fact, that is what I did. I'll tell the truth. I did do that. I did cut and paste. And so even if they had a reciprocal square root, I would have probably initially written it that way because that's how people operate. So, yeah. So that's what the code looks like. So on slide 17 now, the next thing we're going to do is to unroll that inner loop so that instead of calculating the potential for one lattice point at a time for each atom, we are going to calculate several lattice points, or that potential for several points in space in one iteration with one atom. And the reason we're going to do that is it will increase the amount of arithmetic we're doing relative to the number of memory references. The GPU is a floating point monster, and in order to really fully utilize what it's able to do, we have to give it as much opportunity to keep those floating point units busy as possible. So while this seems a little more complex and like extra work and various things, it ends up running a lot faster because the GPU has just heavily weighted on the floating point side. And so basically, one fact of life with this technique is if we start taking more spatial evaluations per thread, we're actually reducing the amount of parallelism that is available in the problem. This trade-off is acceptable for this particular problem because we began with a huge number of independent computations, thousands and thousands and thousands of them. So this trade-off is acceptable only because we have so much parallelism to spare that it's okay. If we didn't have that, though, this might not be a good idea. So in order to keep the tile size of that decomposition approximately similar, or to prevent it from getting very large, which has the negative effects I described earlier with the waste at the edges due to padding, we have to decrease the thread block size. So because there's no longer one-to-one mapping from thread block to computational tile. Now, for a given thread block, we'll be doing a tile that's maybe 1, 2, 4, or 8 times as large. So that's the reason why we want to adjust those thread block sizes. And slide 18, basically what this means is for each atom that we calculate, we are going to load the atom coordinates, atom I and charge I, and the charges, the coordinates of charges, will be used several times in a row. The only thing that will be different are the distance calculations and the individual potential sums that we're calculating. So what this does is, if we unroll that inner loop by a factor of 4, let's say, we will use the same atom coordinates and the same dx, dy, dz will only be changing in one of those dimensions. So in the case of the x dimension, between calculations, only dx will be changing, right? So that greatly reduces both the number of floating point operations and the number of memory references. So the net result of this is we're doing a lot less redundant work from one point to another. So that's the benefit of doing this unrolling. Anybody have any questions about that? So this is a key point, because this will give us a huge speed
up. Yes.
Values.
Yes. You can also use shared memory. If you get too carried away with this, you'll actually run yourself short on registers. So I'll show that later. So what this means, you see now, for each thread in one of these blocks, this is now you see the computational tiles on slide 19 are no longer square. They're more rectangular, and that's because each thread is now doing, say, in this case, 4 potential values per thread. So the computational tile isn't square anymore, even though the original thread block was. So in order, the problem with this is that at the edges, this means that there's a much greater percent chance that we're going to waste a lot of work at the edge than we did before. It also means that the number of CUDA thread blocks we'll be able to tile into this map is now smaller. Where we might have had 16 before, we might only have 9 or 8 or 7 or, you know, a much smaller number now. So this means that we've decreased our parallelism significantly. So if we had a GPU with 384 SMs, this would not be a good trade-off, because even though it runs faster, half of the SMs might be idle. So this is a trade-off to be aware of. When you trade parallelism for speed, it might come back to bite you in the long run.
So that's the, by the way, that's the 1x2, 1x4 rectangular blocking in matrix multiplication as well. It's the same technique.
Yes. Yeah. So now we're on slide 20. So here's a version 2 of this algorithm. Uses constant memory pre-calculation with the same pre-calculated dz squared. And it uses a loop unrolling by a factor of 4. And the new version achieves 259 gigaflops and 33 billion atom evaluations per second. So the previous one was 18.6 or thereabouts. This one is 33. So we almost got a factor of 2 by reducing the number of redundant memory references, arithmetic operations, but at the cost of reducing our parallelism. So the pros are, although the constant memory is very fast, loading those values into the registers even costs instruction slots. And so what we've done here is by unrolling, they're loaded into the registers once, and then we get to use them 4 or more times, depending on how much we unroll it. We can reduce the number of loads by reusing the same atom coordinate values and basically calculating multiple lattice points at a time. So by unrolling x by 4, we can pre-calculate dy squared and dz squared once and use that multiple times. So this is now looking a lot more like the way the CPU SSE version of the code looks. We've basically done some of the same tricks, pre-calculating some of those distant vector components, and it runs that much faster. At this point, so the con about this is you have to do this yourself, because at the moment the compiler doesn't know how to do this kind of transformation. Another negative of this method is it consumes registers, which are, as you know, a finite resource. If we consume too many registers, the code will actually run slower, and it increases the tile size and decreases the thread count in a block. So in general, that's something to be aware of, even though for our particular case, it's not a problem. Does anybody have any questions?
So there's one potentially confusing part about this. What John is talking about here, I believe, is the unrolling of the outer loop.
Yeah.
So there's also an inner loop where each thread will loop through all the atoms.
Yes. So I guess maybe my description isn't clear. So what we've done is in that innermost loop that calculates the contribution of one atom at a time in each pass through the loop, it used to compute a single potential value for each atom, and then it would move on to the next atom.
Right.
And what we've done is instead of calculating just one potential value for that atom, we're using that atom and its data and its position several times, and we're going to add its contribution to a group of lattice points at a time, instead of just one.
Yeah, so in the literature, this technique is actually called unroll and jam. Unfortunately, because this is an outer loop, because it's fairly big, most of the compilers don't even do it because it's very tricky to control the register usage, and sometimes it's very hard to do the dependence analysis to figure out all the cases, so currently they don't bother to do this. It's a known technique, but it turned out to be more difficult to implement than most people envision. So.
And implementing that, implementing that technique into the CPU version was the thing that gave me the extra factor of 2 on the CPU.
Very.
And it was very tricky.
And it was Intel compiler either.
Yeah, it wasn't in the Intel compiler either, and it was actually harder to do on the CPU than it was on the GPU because of the issue with cleanup at the end of the loop and various things like that. So this is what the innermost loop of the potential kernel looks like on the GPU now. You can see that we calculate 4 dx values, and we use the same, we pre-calculate dy squared plus dz squared right here, and then we use that 4 times without having to do anything else. So we're just, the only thing that's changing, as you can see, is the dx component of the distance vector. Everything else is fixed. And so that is why we're achieving a much higher arithmetic intensity. You can see now everything in these 4 identical calculations is coming out of registers, with the exception of the charge. Everything else is coming out of a register. So they get more complex from here. So if you have any questions, ask now. All right. So that's basically the idea. We're just eliminating redundant arithmetic, eliminating memory references. We're doing more than one, we're amortizing the cost of having fetched this stuff from memory, and we're applying it to multiple lattice points. So now on slide 22, version 3 of the code goes farther. And all it's doing differently is it's unrolling by a factor of 8 instead of by a factor of 4. This immediately runs into a brick wall, though, because your register use per thread has now gotten to such a large number that it will actually run slower than the other one will. And the solution to that problem is to use shared memory to store some of the values temporarily while you're doing work with the registers. And so basically what we do is we load the existing potential values from global memory into shared memory, freeing up the registers that would otherwise be consumed. And then by doing that, we can now unroll by a factor of 8 instead of a factor of 4. We just get increased reuse, and we can, the total register count is lower, and we get a higher GPU occupancy, or the number of units that are kept busy. And the negative aspect of this is we've exhausted basically everything. This technique can't go any further because we've used all of the constant memory, most of the shared memory, and a fairly large number of registers for every thread. So there's really, we've painted ourselves into a corner. This technique won't give us, there's nowhere to go from here. This is it. At least for this generation of GPUs, this technique won't pay off anymore. So the way that kernel works is, like I said, it basically stores all those values into global memory, processes 8 lattice points at a time. The only way to get more performance beyond this version is by somehow also doing memory coalescing. And I have another version of the kernel. I'm going to tell you about a simpler one that one of my students came up with. But there's, I have a version of this kernel that does memory coalescing as well, but it's even more complex. none of the subsequent kernels are small enough that I can show you any meaningful code snippets in the lecture here, but they're available for me. Just send me an email and I'll be happy to share them with you.
So John, when yes. you use shared memory, there's another trade-off, because now you need to calculate address.
Yes.
In the to access shared memory. That's
absolutely correct.
Those things will occupy instruction
slots. Yes.
Right. So you know.
In this case, they're only used at the beginning and at the end, not in the innermost loop, so it's
right.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that is a significant issue. One of the other, a totally different algorithm that we wrote about in our recent paper is called multi-level summation. And multi-level summation has a significant amount of complex memory traversal. Not only that, but it's the spatial decompositions it has to use are not entirely friendly to the warp. Size of the GPU. So there are a lot of trade-offs that are made in that code. It still, on the GPU, outruns the CPU version by a large factor, but it's not, you know, a factor of 100 like this is. So, this shared memory, though, in this case, it still is a win because we're only accessing it at the very beginning of the kernel and at the very end. And in the intervening time, we're going to do a few thousand loop iterations. We're not touching it at all.
So you did. In some of the applications that I've worked with, it's useful to, after you issue a global memory load, to delay storing it to shared memory or whatever as long as possible.
That
so.
Would be true, and that's actually one of the problems with this implementation is there's nothing, you don't have any other work you can do until it's stored, you can't really begin your loop.
Because before you had load at the beginning, huge loops, use at the end.
Yes.
And so it didn't matter at all.
Right, and the truth is this, what you saw, the speed of this algorithm, we went from 250-something, or I think it was, up to 268. The payoff for unrolling by 8 was relatively small. We had gotten the majority already by unrolling by 4.
Right.
So we're basically, this is just trying to asymptotically approach the peak that we're going to get out of it. And not only that, but as you point out, it actually has some contractions. Storing immediately into shared memory means we're going to block for global memory access, so we have to have a lot of other blocks ready to go. So that's actually the way that we get away with that is we have so many blocks available to run. If this one goes to sleep because of a global memory access, we have, you know, a number of other blocks ready to go. So, but yeah, that's.
But you really need to push them.
Those were those trade-offs, basically battling. Well, am I using too many registers? The shared memory has a cost to. That's why I describe this as sort of having painted ourselves into a corner, because this one really doesn't have anywhere to go and without significant changes to the code. And we did do another version of this that instead of unrolling in the X direction, it unrolls in the Y direction. And it uses shared memory, does coalesced reads into a shared memory block, has to do with sync threads, runs the loop, does another sync threads, and then writes all these things back. But it's much, and it has, because of the dimensionality, the blocks are basically a hard-coded size. You can't make them any other dimensions than like 16 by 8. If I remember right, or 16 by 12. That one gets, like I say, it gets a little bit faster. That one from maybe 268 and 36, it went to maybe 270 and 37 billion. So it's performance. But one of OneMay's students actually discovered another way to do it, which is much simpler. So that's why I'm not going to talk about the other one we had done. OneMay's student, Christopher Rodriguez, took the CUDA kernels I wrote, and he found another version, another way to write it with memory coalescing that eliminated, he didn't even use shared memory at all. This is what surprised me. He actually got better performance than the very complex version I had. He doesn't use any shared memory. What he does do is he stores his values at the very end. So his only global memory access is at the very end of the kernel. And when I looked at that, I was surprised that it did so well. But because he doesn't have any of the other complexity that's in these other kernels, it ends up winning. So this is slide 24. His kernel, I just did some tweaking on his kernel, and with the tweaks that I did, I got the best performance yet, which is 291 gigaflops and 39.5 billion atom evaluations a second. So like I said, the CPU version was about it's like 2 billion with multiple cores, I forget, but this is a huge speed up over the CPU version. And like I said, he's achieving very high GPU occupancy. His code doesn't have any set dimensionality requirement for the thread blocks because he's not using the shared memory. He's not forced to do these loads and stores in a particular structure. And because his tile size is still multiplied out by the number of unrolls, so he has a factor of 8 unrolling in his. The tiles are still very big, so the problem with this one is sort of the same as the other highly unrolled versions. For one 16 wide by whatever tall CUDA thread block, the computational tile will be 128 wide and however many tall. So the peak performance I got was with 16 by 8 thread blocks, which correspond to a computational tile of 128 by 8. So we're getting most of our parallelism in the Y dimension. We've exhausted the X dimension, and the chances are for any typical, this one has got such a large tile size in the present version that it's actually on the sort of the edge or the fringe of what is a typical problem size. So the interesting part is, can we take Chris's kernel? Is there a way we can refactor things in some way to keep the tremendous performance he got using memory coalescing, but decrease the computational tile size? If we could do that, then this would be the highest performance kernel, and it would work well in a real use case. So as it stands, this one gets the best performance of any of them on the huge problem sizes, but for a typical size problem, version 2 ends up being the fastest because it has a smaller computational tile size. So it's an interesting trade-off.
So,
that's right. The grid, the size of the molecule and the space around it that you need to compute. Yes.
So the typical size of the molecule these days is actually too small for this kind of approach.
Yeah, I would say, in fact, this actually goes back to the original reason to have to write this code. There are many molecules where there are tons of other codes that work adequately well, depending on whether it's a nucleic acid or whether or not it's a protein. And they're also typically a lot smaller. If you have a 10,000 atom molecule or even 100,000 atom molecule, they may be small enough that you don't need to do any of these things. But once you start building a simulation box for something where the molecule is nucleic acid and it has a 250,000 atoms before you've even added the water, by the time you add the water and the ions, you're at a few million atoms. Now it's or it's a virus. Let's say a virus capsid has a big, has a big cavity inside, but it occupies a very large volume. Those are all things that sort of push you in this direction. As computers get faster, people will do bigger simulations, and we will eventually grow into this realm. So this will actually be a normal size problem maybe in 5 years. We don't know.
So that's another tricky issue with all these applications. There's no single solution, optimal for all these different experiments and different configurations.
Right? That's right.
Yeah, so that's something that all of you need to figure out for your own application, what that means.
Yeah, and it may pay off to have, for example, in VMD, I have coded three different kernels. And at the present, it's just using one of them. But if we did a benchmark step when the program started, I could predict where the crossover points for the different kernels is. I mean, of course, since we have this generation of CUDA hardware, we can actually determine this from first principles and plot it, and we will know what the crossover points are. But when they come out with new GPUs with varying numbers of SMs and various things, you'll have to die. Chris's version processes 8 lattice points at a time in the inner loop. He offsets the subsequent grid points, not by one coordinate in the X or Y or Z dimension, but rather by an entire half warp. And by doing that, he is guaranteeing that they have a coalesced memory access when they read and write global memory values. This is the key thing that he's doing that gives him the speed. By getting the global memory accesses coalesced, he's greatly reducing the speed hit for having fetched those existing potential values. So then he basically works on those 8 lattice points at a time, and he writes them out to global memory only at the end. So he doesn't even fetch them at the beginning. The other kernels that I showed previously, they fetch the existing potential value when they start, they do their work, and they write their results at the end. Chris actually took a different strategy. By not loading them up front, he avoided consuming registers, which means he didn't have to worry about using shared memory. So it was a completely different tack. He managed to completely avoid register starvation by not loading them until the very end. And because he basically does an increment of the global memory value, he's doing all that global memory access at once. But presumably, it is much more easy to overlap because he's done a lot of work already. If there are other blocks that are runnable, he's probably going to have an easier time overlapping. But the important part is, in practice, his code runs faster. So. And this is the way it looks on slide 26. You can see that the threads, instead of calculating contiguous lattice points in space, they are spread out. They are drawn to scale here, but you can see they're spread out by a half warp. So they're skipping large numbers of values, and that's how he's getting the coalesced memory access. Any questions about that?
Just to drive the point home, when you eventually write the global memory, it's really, each of these points are actually done separately in different steps, and all the warp threads will be writing consecutive locations each step, right?
Yeah, if I could make another version of this slide, for example, that colors this first block red, then green, then blue or something, and that would correspond to loop iteration one, or, the step one, step two, step three, and so on. And there would be a whole half warp at a time doing those in consecutive locations.
So, John, how much time do you think it will take to finish the slides?
Probably just a few minutes, because the remainder, we're done with the hard part now, and the rest is more fun stuff.
That sounds good.
So, so the next part of the talk was basically about using multiple GPUs in parallel, so assigning these different slices to different GPUs. So since a typical potential map might have 50 to 500 slices in the Z dimension, we have a lot of parallelism that we haven't even tapped yet, which we can use to keep several GPUs busy at once. The version 2 algorithm, now I haven't even had a chance to try Chris's yet, but I assume his would do very well on the large maps. But the version 2 algorithm works very well on the average case, and that is the version I'll show you some numbers for. So the way this works is, on the host, we make a new host thread to manage each GPU. So we do like a pthread create. We create a new thread. The first thing that thread does is it attaches to the CUDA context for a matching device. So we give each thread its own CUDA device. One of the tricky parts about all this is if an error occurs in a child thread, you have to somehow communicate that back to, and someday I'll get people not to call me during a talk. If an error occurs while you're running in one of these threads, you have to somehow terminate what you're doing, get back to the host controlling thread, and halt all of the other calculations that might be running concurrently on the other GPUs. This is kind of tricky. So you have to think about when you're writing a code that runs a bunch of GPUs, what do you do if something bad happens on one of them? It's like starting a freight train running, and one of the cars on the freight train had just had a wheel fall off. Uh-oh. You know, there's a lot of momentum there. You're not going to stop it on a dime. These GPUs, man, once you tell them go, they go. They don't talk to you until they're done, you know. So the difficulty is you don't have an easy way of reining them in. If you've sent them off on a mission, they are not going to come back until they're done. And so you have to sort of plan for this. There's no way to deal with this after the fact. You have to actually architect your code to solve this problem. So I don't know, for the purposes of your class, this may not be a big concern since you're mainly worried about performance. But in a real world code, it isn't acceptable to crash and burn. So you're going to have to figure out how to solve that. So we can easily assign these slices of a potential map to multiple GPUs. And we can just do this in a round robin fashion, you know, every other slice and so on. One nice coincidental property of these map slices is they're typically larger than the size of the host machine's memory page. And that is good because we don't have to worry about problems like false sharing and NUMA cache performance issues. This may not be a big deal but in most cases, but when the GPUs produce results very quickly. And so you would otherwise have to put mutex locks and things around these memory pages to protect them so that they don't overwrite each other. And or destroy each other's performance. So on slide 29, I've shown an example. This is one of our test machines. It has three GeForce 8800 GTX cards in it with a little quad-core Intel CPU. One of the neat things about the GPU implementation is since each GPU has its own independent memory subsystem, as we add GPUs, the available memory bandwidth for the problem scales with the number of GPUs. This is not the case with the CPU implementation. One of the first things you discover running the code on a large shared memory machine is beyond a certain number of CPUs, you no longer get any additional performance. And the reason is that those CPU cores share a memory system. Typically, the memory bandwidth is a few tens of gigabytes a second if you're lucky. Each GPU by itself has a memory bandwidth of 100 gigabytes a second or thereabouts. So if you have three or four of these guys, you very quickly have amassed a tremendous amount of memory bandwidth, and the beautiful part is, as you add another GPU, you're adding both the memory bandwidth and the arithmetic capability to keep it busy. For this particular problem, so the shared resource that could be a constraint for a multi-GPU problem is the PCI Express bus, or the host memory bandwidth. For our particular problem, the amount of work that's being done on the GPU versus the amount of memory bandwidth or PCI Express bandwidth that's consumed to keep them busy is in favor of the GPU. So we might, for several seconds, keep the GPU busy for every fraction of a second that we're utilizing the host memory or the host PCI Express bus. So I don't know what the scalability limit is. We haven't had enough GPUs yet to even touch that yet. So perhaps we could keep 20 or 30 GPUs busy if we had a similar bus speed. And that's just on one host. If we used a cluster, you know, there's no limit. So with three GPUs and the version 2 algorithm that I showed earlier, we get about 97 billion atom potential evaluations per second, which is 750 gigaflops. in a machine that cost about $4,500. Not bad. So we used to run this kind of calculation on 140 processors of an SGI Altix. So there's an obvious advantage to going this route. For one, we can have this machine in a closet or under a desk or in our machine room, and our group can afford to own one just for setting up these simulations. This is a big deal because otherwise our researchers would have to wait in line in a queue on a supercomputer running a CPU version of the code, and it might still, even though they can use a lot of the parallelism after we wrote the parallel version of the code, it's inconvenient. It's a problem for them. So by running it on this machine, though, it's becoming, basically it's a no-brainer. It's no big deal. They can do it on demand. If they make a mistake, wasting 15 GPU wall clock minutes on these three GPUs is no big deal. Wasting 140 CPU hours on an Altix would be a costly mistake, so we don't want to do that. And the other thing is, if we can do anything on the GPU, we should, because we should save the CPUs for use by codes that really don't, either can't or don't have any other way to run. So that makes those CPU hours available to somebody else for a different problem. Another thing that's cool about the GPU solution is this machine only uses 700 watts with all four cores and all three GPUs running full speed flat out. You don't even want to contemplate what the equivalent number of watts being used by a few hundred Altix nodes is. It's a large number. And I've done a very quick benchmark on a dual quadruplex machine and achieved 138 billion atom potential evaluations per second, which is about 1.1 teraflops. So that's not bad at all.
So this is still version 2, right?
Yes, that's still version 2. So at some point in the next week or two, I will work with Chris and we will try his code and see what sort of numbers we can get. I would be willing to bet that we can get at least 1.2 teraflops, maybe 1.3 teraflops using his kernel instead.
But you need to set up bigger molecules.
Yes, that's right. So we'll have to, but I also think there should be a way, maybe if we unroll his in the Y dimension instead of X or something like that, we might be able to get the computational tile size down a little bit, or we might be able to take his version and unroll by a different factor. There are a number of things we could do that would probably get most of the speed. But that's the thing, we'll move the trade-off back the other way a little bit so we can get more of the speed in the average case. We can keep his full speed kernel just for the very, very large systems.
Yeah. So that's the reason why we're trying to get this Spacewalker thing available to, you know, some form to the students this semester.
Yeah. So to give you an example, the original ion placement run for the virus, which was Peter's structure, took 110 CPU hours on the Altix. And now we can do it in 1.3 GPU hours with the version 2 kernel. And so that's a factor of 82 times faster, or give or take. And with three GPUs, we can get that to 27 minutes of wall clock time. So that's not bad at all. So you can see that's a huge difference. For the ribosome structure, which is even larger, the speed up is 110. And we can get about the equivalent of, with three GPUs, it would be like running on 330 Altix CPUs.
Question?
Yes.
How much faster would you want to go?
Well, you know, and that's actually a very good point. That's a very good question for a number of things. So, for example, how fast is fast enough? It depends on the problem. I think for the problems that we're regularly working on now, in practice, we're patient enough, we can do something else for 15 minutes. If we use three GPUs, it is now, you know, that's another way to look at it. How much programmer time is it worth to get another factor of 1.1 once you're already this fast? I don't know. I think that at some point it's cheaper to buy two GPUs and not worry about it. It's fast enough already. Or to use three GPUs or four GPUs. And I bet NVIDIA would like that too. I don't know. There is a trade-off, human time versus machine time. I think once you get to, I think honestly a lot of people, unless they're maniacal like some of us are, just there is sort of a curiosity, how fast can I make it go to better understand the hardware? But I think, to be quite honest, once you're at 100 times faster, you should call it done and buy more GPUs. That's what I think. For different, you know, codes, that cutoff time is different. Like actually Kirby Vandervoort in the back row, he and I helped Anton make a totally different code run on CUDA. And the original CPU time was about an hour. And then we worked on the CPU code for a week and a half and got it down to 8.5 minutes. And that's still pretty slow for something that you want to try many, many different combinations of settings, sort of like turning a dial and seeing what happens. For something like that where you're searching through a range of possible simulations, you want it even faster. So we worked on the GPU and got it down to 38 seconds. Now, and that was not that hard. I think we spent a lot more time on the CPU code, maybe by a factor of 4. I think we spent 4 times as much time making the CPU code fast before we even started on the GPU. We did the GPU code, and Kirby, who had never even done CUDA before, I gave him a prototype that didn't work and said, here, good luck. And then I had to fly out to, I had to give a talk somewhere. And I left him holding the bag, and he finished it the next 8 seconds. And, you know, that was pretty cool. But, you know, and we just did a very simple, straightforward implementation. And all it did, there weren't enough floating point operations per element in this code to really, you know, pull out some of the tricks that we used in the Coulomb summation algorithm. So the strategy with that code was just overlapping arithmetic and global memory accesses, and just doing that we got about a factor of 12, I think, over the CPU code. And for us, 38 seconds, I think we determined for real world use is good enough. Now there was a side of us, I think both Kirby and I, in the back of our minds have a little bit of an itch. We would like to know, could we get it faster? But in practice it's already, now 38 seconds is very good. So. Oh, it's 38 seconds.
What's the mean?
What's the term mean?
Oh. So, these other numbers I gave, when you start running on multiple CPUs and multiple GPUs, you start calculating things in CPU hours or GPU hours or GPU minutes. And the reason is, if I don't want to have to worry about, did he run the job on 100 processors on the Altix or did he run it on 4? I mean, those will give very different wall clock times, but assuming you have good scalability or near linear scalability, which these codes get, we don't want to worry about those details. They're a distraction. So in fact, this calculation was done originally, I think, on 18 CPUs, and one of the other ones, I think this one ran on 141.
Yes, we did one for...
So, yeah. But those are details that are interesting insofar as studying the performance of the shared memory code. But assuming it scales linearly with the number of CPUs, which extremely data parallel codes like this do, there's no reason to worry about that. So we just worry about CPU hours and GPU hours or GPU minutes, because if it's going to scale linearly, then you don't care about the number that were used. So wall clock time is interesting because that's the metric that a user cares about. They don't care about unless they're paying for it. If they're paying for it, they probably care about CPU hours. But wall clock time in terms of what it means to me in my day doing my work, how many minutes will it take me? Do I have to wait until I get an answer? The wall clock time is what a user cares about. So this is basically another application of the same algorithm is to average the electrostatic field over the course of a simulation trajectory. So instead of taking a molecular structure where all the atom positions are fixed and do not change, we now take the same calculation, but we calculate the electrostatic field for numerous time steps where the atoms are moving, dynamics. So we have a dynamics, sort of a recording of what happened in the simulation. And we want to average that field over time to give more of a representative electrostatic field rather than being skewed maybe arbitrarily towards one particular structural conformation. This is more representative of the dynamics of the whole structure. And so this is something what nobody would have ever even attempted to do before. So this is really maybe what's even more exciting about GPUs than anything else. It's really cool that we could let Peter do his ion placement in 27 minutes instead of multiple hours or multiple days or a month. But what's even cooler than that is to be able to do something nobody's ever even tried before, because it's so computationally costly, it's unconceivable. So multiply the amount of work that we would have done by a factor of 1,000, and that's what we're talking about for a time averaged potential like this. So we're going to do that same calculation 1,000 times, and we're going to average those potential values for each of those steps together to produce a new map. And then once we have that time averaged map, this can be used to accelerate a molecular dynamics simulation to make it run faster by ignoring the outer parts of the structure. So if we can average the exterior elements of some structure that are far away, we can then simulate maybe the interesting part much, much faster by freezing that outer potential. So I've implemented several of these CUDA kernels in VMD, which is a very large molecular visualization program, which is actually what my day job is. And basically integrating these different algorithms into VMD is what allows us to do those time-averaged potential calculations. Some of the challenges you encounter with this are you have to handle the case where a CUDA isn't installed. You have to maintain both a CPU and a CUDA version of these kernels. One of the problems you run into is you have different implementations of the same algorithm. The CUDA algorithm might diverge significantly from the CPU algorithm, or you might actually take a totally different algorithm to compute the same quantity in the more extreme case. And from a code maintenance point of view, that makes it a little more tricky. So it's much harder than just writing normal CPU code, because you now have twice as much to worry about. And you have, you know, further complexity if you want to use multiple GPUs. Now you have single-threaded GPU implementation, single-threaded CPU implementation, multi-threaded implementations of both. So you have a lot of different branches. So the way I approached this for VMD is for each of the CUDA kernels that we added, at least thus far, we made a simple wrapper that basically encapsulates the CPU version and the CUDA version. And that encapsulation has some simple logic. This is on slide 34 for those of you listening, that basically tests to see if how the code was compiled. If CUDA was enabled, then it counts the number of GPUs that are available. If they're available, then it basically attempts to calculate the quantities with CUDA. If an error occurs and the CUDA kernel bails out for some reason, many reasons that could happen. You could have a situation where the calculation runs too long and exceeds the watchdog timer, and so your kernel gets terminated. You could run the GPU out of memory. Somebody else could be using the GPU already and they've consumed all the memory, so there's none left for you. A lot of different things can happen, so you have to have a fallback. And if something bad happens, then you basically go back and run the CPU kernel. Now, that sounds great, but so here's a question. If the CPU is 100 times slower than the GPU, what's the point of falling back?
Mm-hmm. It's the same thing as graphics today.
Yeah, exactly. It gets to the point, basically, if it's 100 times slower, you might as well just return a hard error and say this failed. Going back to the CPU isn't actually very useful. It's so much slower, it's basically unusable. And I think it's like one may have said, basically, if you were playing your favorite video game, let's say you're playing Quake, if the video card returns an error and won't run, you don't play Quake anyway. You throw up your hands and you go get another GPU, or you fix the machine. You're not willing to play Quake at a half a frame. That's the analogy. 30 frames a second versus a frame a minute. No, we're not going to play Quake on the CPU. Not going to happen.
Yeah.
So these problems, you know, a lot of these complexity issues are not specific to CUDA. You ought to see some of the other scientific codes that are out there. I read through over the weekend one of the popular molecular dynamics codes that's out there. It has a lot of assembly language loops. they have probably 50 or 60 different machine language, assembly language loops. These are just for the Intel chips, and each one of those has to be verified and maintained and kept current. And this has nothing to do with GPUs. So there are already people who are seeking peak performance have gone to great pain and suffering to make their codes run fast, even if it made the maintenance of the code somewhat. So basically for the code organization, the main application has all the normal data structures and so on. We add all the CUDA kernels into a single header file, which makes it easy to find and call them without adding a lot of complexity to the existing code. And we put each CUDA kernel in its own .cu file. And the reason, at least historically, this may not be an issue with the new versions of CUDA, but with the older versions of CUDA, this eliminated problems where you had multiple kernels using shared resources like constant memory and things like that. The older compilers didn't know what to do about that. They assumed that all of them were using them, and so it would cause you some trouble. But this worked around that limitation. Whether or not that's even necessary now, I'm not sure. So I guess the summary is the GPUs aren't the magic bullet, but if you use them intelligently, they can be amazing. So it's up to you to decide if the GPU is the right solution to the problem, and you have to, sometimes you have to take an unconventional approach to make the problem fit the GPU well. And there are a lot of different strategies you can take. And like I said a few times during the talk, you can't do a GPU implementation unless you understand the algorithm that you're working with. Some, like I said, sometimes you might work on it on the CPU for a week and a half, and then the GPU version only takes you a day. But that's most of what's unsaid there, really digging, understanding the code very well, the algorithm, trying to grasp all the different dimensionalities that you could map onto different parts of the hardware, whether it's the CPU or the GPU. And if you're able to use all of the GPU features, you know, like if the way a GPU can really be fast, if you take advantage of several of its advantages, like the you have arithmetic intensity, you have so many streaming processors, you have a tremendous opportunity to run a huge number of calculations concurrently. It also has very high memory bandwidth. It has the texture memory, which will do things like the coordinate clamping and the linear interpolation. If you're able to take advantage of several of those things at once, that's where you can get a speed up that's much larger than you might have predicted, because you have a lot of advantages over the CPU. And we have one of our published papers and various other references and source code are posted on our website, and you can send me email. I would like to thank my co-authors who've worked with me on some of these problems, Peter and Kirby and Anton and some of the other guys that aren't here today, and Professor Wenmei Wu, David Kirk, and all the CUDA guys at NVIDIA and our NIH who supports us with funding.
Hey.
Thanks.
So, John? Yes. There are several project sheets at the website, mm-hmm. and would you be still interested in maybe updating a few of those and mm-hmm. continue to sponsor some projects? I know that some of your colleagues will be doing projects, but you know it would be nice,
absolutely,
to have two, three updated sheets,
absolutely,
so that you know people can still pick from those.
Yeah, we still have a lot of problems that could be very well implemented on the GPU, I think. And some of the projects that students did last semester, they've made great advances in the quality of the CUDA compilers and tools, and we understand the hardware better. I think all of us understand the hardware better now than we did at the beginning. So a lot of things that seemed untenable before might be possible now. So
good. Very good. Hey, thanks again.
So tomorrow afternoon, Sam Stone. There are two Stones here. So Sam Stone is going to talk about MRI, a similar talk but in a different perspective, so you can get more insights.
Okay.
So see you tomorrow afternoon. Wonderful.
So is it okay? Well,